The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 30th of November, 2021, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Daniel Bage. Coming up on today's program: as the world reacts to the Omicron variant with travel bans and booster jab campaigns, we'll hear about how two global powers are planning to tackle vaccine apartheid.
The United States wants to strengthen our partnerships across Africa in ways that serve your interests, our interests.
While the U.S. makes a renewed pledge, it's China that is stepping up. We'll discuss that. And then Barbados is the world's newest republic.
The time has come to fully leave our colonial past behind. Barbadians want a Barbadian head of state.
We'll get reaction as the Caribbean nation officially cuts ties with the British royal family. And later we'll check in with our Tokyo bureau chief, Fiona Wilson, to discuss an increase in Japan's military spending amidst growing threats from North Korea and China. Plus, we'll hear from our Toronto bureau chief, Thomas Lewis, as Canada taps into our precious maple syrup reserves. All that right here on The Briefing with me, Daniel Bage. A growing list of countries have cancelled flights from southern Africa, hoping to shield themselves from the new Omicron COVID variant. South Africa's president, Cyril Ramaphosa, says the bans are, quote, scientifically unjustified. But as uncertainty over the new variant swirls, China has stepped up its vaccine diplomacy. President Xi Jinping has pledged to donate another 1 billion doses of COVID-19 vaccines to the African continent, on top of the nearly 200 million jabs already supplied to several African countries by China. Xi Jinping's promise comes during a critical China-Africa summit in Senegal, which critics view as part of the superpower strategy to increase its influence over the continent. Well, joining me now for more is Isabel Hilton, CEO of China Dialogue. Good afternoon to you, Isabel.
Hi.
Where, when, I guess, are the main questions here. What has been announced first by China?
Well, China has announced that it will supply another billion doses of vaccines, 600 million of which will be donated. And the rest it's a proposition that they be jointly produced in Africa by Chinese enterprises. So those details have yet to come, but it's a substantial offer.
What did President Xi have to say about what he hopes to achieve and their greater reasoning for this?
Well, his message was in the context of a general message about prosperity and health. And after all, health has been part of the offer on the so-called Belt and Road, you know, China's big development project. Africa is a very important market for China, but also an important supplier of various kinds of raw materials. And China has had an enormous diplomatic and trade push in Africa for the best part of a decade. So for the continent to be suffering from COVID quite as it is, you know, all the indicators are down. And so there's an element of self-interest, but also it allows Xi Jinping to present China as a kind of concerned power, as opposed to the West, which has been accused of hoarding vaccines and so on. So, you know, for example, at COP26, at the climate conference, there was a great deal of resentment from African countries about the general neglect, not just on climate, but also on vaccines, and the sense that wealthy countries really look after their own interests, that they hoard vaccines, that they don't donate, they don't share. And that's something that, you know, that's an opportunity for Xi Jinping to present China, as I say, as a different kind of power.
Well, that's interesting. What do you make of the timing? Obviously, there's this Omicron variant, which has sent the world scrambling to lock down and increase booster campaigns. We heard a clip from Anthony Blinken off the top there. The U.S. has made pledges, but it's China that's acting more quickly here. What of the timing, and what are they saying about when they can actually get vaccines to people?
That's not really clear yet. The timing is clearly, you know, it's the showpiece offer, if you like, at the annual China-Africa summit. It also, I have to say, comes at a time, you know, China has moved pretty quickly on using vaccines as a kind of diplomatic tool and has been offering vaccines around the world under various conditions. But the take-up of that offer has tended to be declining because there are quite major doubts about the efficacy of Chinese vaccines. So when Delta came along, you find countries like Thailand, which had a big outbreak of Delta, turning really very quickly to Western vaccines because it didn't trust the Chinese ones to be as effective. So when countries can get hold of other vaccines, that's what they tend to do. But in the meantime, you know, you get countries which have very, very low vaccination rates, as most of Africa has, and Chinese vaccines tend to be more available. They're also being donated to the WHO vaccination program. So there are various routes by which these vaccines can reach countries, but they tend, as I say, they tend to be very useful in a kind of first wave, or certainly very widely accepted in a first wave. But as soon as countries can upgrade, they tend to do so.
You mentioned China's diplomatic offensive on the continent, of course, and they will have interest as part of the Greater Belt and Road. But talk to us about this specific campaign and boosting capacity for countries in Africa to make their own vaccines. You know, critics will often say with these announcements that China is acting in its own interest and there are strings attached.
Well, I think that in terms of the donations, that seems to be pretty straightforward. It's not really clear in terms of the proposition that Chinese companies help to manufacture vaccines in Africa, quite what the terms and conditions do. But that's, again, something that African countries would welcome, because African leaders often say that Africa ought to be able to manufacture vaccines. And these are relatively straightforward vaccines to manufacture. They're less technically advanced than the Western ones. So, I think that China would also present this as an act of cooperation and not just an act of philanthropy. And that would play, again, would play quite well in Africa. You know, China's activities in Africa are sustained and quite profound at this point. It's the biggest trade partner of most of Africa. And its investment in Africa has just, you know, rocketed for over a decade at a time when Western countries didn't seem to be terribly interested. So China has a very strong diplomatic footprint over Africa. And I think that this will, on the whole, be well received.
Isabel, thank you for this update. That is the editor and founder of China Dialogue, Isabel Hilton. Now, Monocle's Tom Edwards is here with today's other news headlines.
Thank you very much indeed, Daniel. The World Health Organization has warned that the new Omicron COVID-19 variant poses severe consequences should it cause infections to surge worldwide. Meanwhile, US President Joe Biden told Americans not to panic and said vaccinations and masks rather than lockdowns will be the best way to cope with the new strain. A Myanmar court has deferred a ruling on charges against Aung San Suu Kyi, the country's elected leader who was ousted by a military coup in February. Suu Kyi has been held since June for incitement and violations of COVID-19 protocols, charges she denies. The World Bank plans to give up to $500 million from a frozen Afghanistan aid fund to humanitarian agencies in the country. Board members will reportedly meet today to discuss the proposal. More than half of Afghanistan's population face famine after US troops withdrew and the Taliban regained control of the country last summer. And today's Monocle Minute reports that Disney Plus has launched in Hong Kong without an episode of The Simpsons in which the cartoon family visit Tiananmen Square. It's not clear whether the streaming service removed the episode or was ordered to do so by Chinese authorities. You can find out more by heading to monocle.com/minute. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Daniel, with a question.
Sure.
If you were a Simpsons character, who would you be? I'm going to say Mo Sizlak.
I love Mo Sizlak. I would have to say it wouldn't be Barney Gumble, that's for sure. I mean, I think I would be Groundskeeper Willie.
Agreed. Glad we talked about this.
And you, Tom?
It's got to be Homer.
I can see that. Tom, thank you so much. That is Monocle's Tom Edwards. Now, the world is today one republic richer as Barbados celebrates its first day of full sovereignty. Yesterday, Dame Sandra Mason was confirmed as the island's first president. Prince Charles attended the ceremony to mark the country's historic break with British imperial rule. Take a listen.
From the darkest days of our past and the appalling atrocity of slavery, which forever stains our history, the people of this island forged their path with extraordinary fortitude. Emancipation, self-government, and independence were your waypoints. Freedom, justice, and self-determination have been your guides.
In his speech, the Prince of Wales also reaffirmed the close partnership between Barbados and the United Kingdom. Well, earlier, Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to Victor Fernandez, chairman of Capital Media in Barbados and the longest-serving elected president of the Caribbean Broadcasting Union. He started by asking Victor whether this decision had been politically divisive in Barbados.
I don't think it's terribly divisive, really. I mean, politically, you will always get people on the opposing side. That is your job, to oppose, I suppose. But look, this has been the subject of two national consultations. There was the Cox Commission of 1979, and then there was the Sir Henry Ford's Commission of 1999, which was the subject of widespread national consultations on the whole question of Barbados's new constitution, Barbados becoming a republic, and that sort of stuff, and so on. So I don't really think there's been some talk, some chatter from some sources that perhaps you should have put it to a referendum. But I mean, if this has been the subject of so many national consultations over such a long period, there's been no real protests or anything like that. More of the discussion is centered around the Charter of Barbados and the references to God being now the creator. But the Prime Minister has been at pains to point out that this is not a legally binding document. This is not the Constitution, and that the preamble to the Constitution, which references God, has not changed and will not be changed. So overall, I would say that there has been pretty widespread acceptance. We did some Vox Pop interviews over the last couple of days, and everybody was very much supportive. But there's not this euphoric kind of a feeling in the country. It's very kind of calm. I guess as the activities continue, the celebratory activities, and we've had quite a few over the last couple of days, there is some excitement building.
And as you've said, Victor, it's all been done fairly peacefully. I mean, Prince Charles was attending the ceremony as well. So I think Barbados, I mean, will remain quite a close ally to the United Kingdom in that sense, right?
Well, absolutely. And, you know, it was really kind of folly on the part of a British member of parliament to actually state that Barbados, you know, was quote unquote selling out to China, whatever that meant. And then you had a lead writer in the Sunday Times, I believe, erroneously stating that Barbados was leaving the Commonwealth. Barbados is not leaving the Commonwealth. It very much remains a part of the Commonwealth, much like other Caribbean countries that are republics, much like Trinidad and Tobago and Dominica. And there are likely to be others that will follow too as well, but will remain part of the Commonwealth of Countries. And Barbados's association relationship with the United Kingdom remains firmly strong. We welcome more British visitors to Barbados on an annual basis. Right now, our hotels are overpopulated with British visitors. So that is not going to change in any way, shape or fashion.
And Victor, what can you tell us about, you know, the new head of state, your Barbados first president, Dame Sandra Mason, incredible woman, incredible career. But what can you tell us about her and what will be her relationship with the prime minister as well?
Well, the role of the president, like the governor general, is largely ceremonial. The head of state is the titular head of state. the prime minister remains as the political arm of the country. But look, let's talk about Dame Sandra Mason for a moment. She's highly respected, comes from a rural family, a rather large family in the parish of St. Philip. The people from St. Philip, I think they're more nationalistic than most people in Barbados. They refer to themselves as Philippians and to the Republic of St. Philip. In fact, they've been using that term for a very long time. She's an attorney by training. She was a magistrate. She's highly respected in her field. She was acclaimed by all sides when invited to become the Governor General of Barbados. And it was with unanimous acclamation that she was also invited to be the first president of the Republic.
Victor, I was going to ask, especially in the Caribbean, I would say, do you think other countries will follow the lead of Barbados on the decision to become a republic?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, it's pretty much inevitable. You know, it's part of a process of delinking from the colonial past. There is no disrespect meant to the monarch or to her successors. In fact, as we speak this morning, Prince Charles is being accorded the highest national honor, along with the Governor General, former Governor General, now President, will be the recipient of the Freedom of Barbados Award, which is the highest award possible under the new Republican form of governance. That in itself should send a message. Now, for me, and you may have deduced from my comments, that I am very much in favor of Barbados becoming a republic, but it didn't make a lot of sense to me. For example, let's say Barbados sends an ambassador to Washington. That ambassador could not take up his or her responsibilities unless they first had a letter signed by the Queen saying, I approve this appointment of my ambassador to Washington. Doesn't make a lot of sense, does it? So I don't think in the normal scheme of things, there's going to be a lot of change in terms of our daily lives, but it does give you that sense of being now completely independent of your former colonial master.
That is Victor Fernandez, chairman of Capital Media in Barbados, speaking to Monocle senior correspondent Fernando Augusto Pacheco. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. You're back with The Briefing on Monocle 24. We turn now to Japan, where the government has approved a record boost in its defense budget. Japan plans to add $6.75 billion, or around 760 billion Japanese yen, to its annual military spending. This in a bid to bolster its air and maritime capabilities amid growing threats posed by North Korea and China. Well, for more on this, let's hear from Monocle's Asia editor and Tokyo bureau chief, Fiona Wilson. Fiona, good evening. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good evening.
Tell us what the government is announcing here.
Well, last week, the supplementary budget went through, and as expected, there was a supplement to the defence budget. The defence budget was already very large. It's now gone up to, it's about $53 billion for this year. And this is the extra money that you just mentioned. And that's going towards bolstering defence. It will, you know, it will be anti-sub weapons, it'll be surface-to-air missiles, patrol aircraft. I think it really reflects Japan's current situation, which is big concerns, China encroaching in its territorial space, and also North Korea. Missiles are flying over from North Korea. They can now reach Japanese territory. So these are the big two concerns. There's also obviously a big issue about what's going to happen with Taiwan. And you have to remember that if you look at a map, the far, far west of Japan is only 100 kilometers from Taiwan. So what happens there is very, very important to Japan. So all these issues have come together. And Fumio Kishida, the prime minister, wanted to take some of the budget from next year, really, and bring it all forward to get some of this equipment underway and really bolster the capabilities as soon as possible.
We have, of course, seen the change of prime ministers a couple of times since 2020, of course. Yoshihide Suga in office for a short time. Fumio Kishida, how is he trying to sort of, let's say, stamp his authority on these concerns?
Well, it's an interesting question. I think he was always seen as more of a dove than a hawk. He wasn't seen as one of these very strong politicians who was hard on defence. He was seen as quite, you know, taking a more conciliatory approach. you know, he's a former foreign minister. He's been in all these big negotiations. But I noticed in the run-up to the election in October, he was talking about increasing defence spending. I mean, Japan has traditionally kept its defence spending to 1% of GDP or under 1% of GDP. This current year is just over 1%. And in the manifesto for the election in October, they were talking about pushing up to 2%. They were very vague on detail. I think doubling defence spending would be extremely problematic in Japan. I think that would be a very long process. But I think it also reflects the fact that America would like Japan to spend more on its own defense. And apparently there was a phone call between Biden and Fumio Kishida in October after he was elected to that effect. And I think really Japan is acknowledging that by increasing its spending. And it's a sort of statement of intent towards to America to show that it does intend to spend more.
What's the reaction been so far? We've talked many times about the pacifist constitution and how it's been difficult for Japan in recent years or in recent past to increase spending. How's it gone down in the media and amongst people across the country?
Yeah, I don't think anyone's that surprised because it had sort of been flagged up by Kishida. He's been talking about increasing spending, talking about the severity of the national security situation. There's been a lot of talk like that. I think many people feel that Japan's economy is struggling, you know, because of COVID. And people are questioning, do we really want to make these massive increases in defense spending right now? But, you know, there is a reality to Japan's security situation. There's no doubt, you know, that when you look at Japan's neighborhood, it's quite difficult for the country at the moment. And it does have to spend more money. Many people have agreed that that is the reality. You know, sometimes there's not enough detail in these broad brush statements. But I think there's a mixed reaction, I would say. A lot of people are quite happy with Japan's pacifist constitution. They don't really want to change the defense situation. But I think, you know, you have to face the reality that America definitely wants Japan to spend more. And, you know, the situation has changed massively. China has doubled spending in a decade. And, you know, it's still, however much Japan is spending, is absolutely dwarfed by what China is spending. And I think looking ahead, you know, China is looking at 2050 to equal or surpass America. So, you know, that this is where Japan is now. So very, very interesting times.
Just lastly, Fiona, you mentioned earlier the threat to Taiwan. Obviously, Japan and its allies, most importantly, the U.S., very concerned about this. I'm curious about how those conversations move forward and what the Prime Minister is saying about that.
Yeah, I think, you know, they make very conciliatory noises towards Taiwan. Japan and Taiwan have had very good relations, you know, for many years. Japan has always spoken in support of Taiwan. It's very, very difficult balancing act for Japan because obviously China is such a massive trading partner. It doesn't want to upset China. But I think recently it's become a little bit more outspoken in support of Taiwan. It's always been a slightly unspoken support. Now it's become more explicit. And I think that's because America has taken a much more explicit line on offering support to Taiwan in the event of war. So I think, you know, Japan is slightly sheltered by America, but it will be relieved to see that America is taking a strong stance on Taiwan. It's just too close to Japan to do anything else.
Fiona, thank you for this. That was Monocle's Tokyo Bureau Chief Fiona Wilson. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. And finally today, as the world grapples with oil supply shortages, Canada is facing a scarcity of another liquid gold. To keep up with global demand, the Quebec Maple Syrup Producers Group has announced it will release 50 million pounds of its emergency maple syrup reserves, about half of its total stockpile. Well, for more on this sticky situation, we are joined by Monocle's Toronto Bureau Chief, Thomas Lewis. Good morning to you, Thomas.
Good morning, Danielle.
I'm sure you've had some maple syrup on your pancakes to start the day before joining us. Talk to us about what is happening here and the reason for this tap into a emergency reserve.
Well, as you rightly say, Daniel, it's a bit of a sticky situation that the Federation of Maple Syrup Producers in Quebec, that body is often referred to, I should say, in shorthand as the OPEC of maple syrup. And they are responding to two things. One, a surge in demand during the height of the pandemic. We've seen reports that global demand rose by about, between 27 and maybe 36 6%, depending on which news outlet that's reporting on this story you believe. And also this spring, so the producers in Quebec have noted, was shorter and warmer than usual, which aren't perfect conditions for the season when maple syrup producers, they tap the maple trees and bring out the liquid gold, as you described it, from the trees ready to be processed and to be sold around the world. So a perfect storm of two events, if you like, that the maple syrup producers, the federation that represents them, have tried to head off here. I think it is worth noting that I think the tone of the coverage here in Canada of this story has been relatively lighthearted. It's not a small story in any stretch. Quebec produces around 73%, I believe, of the world's maple syrup supply, and the biggest customer is south of the border in the US. It's a very lucrative and very big part of the food and drink economy in Quebec. But there hasn't been a big sort of sense of alarm or emergency or being too over the top about the situation yet. But they are certainly trying to head it off before people start noticing shortages of maple syrup on their supermarket shelves, Daniel.
Well, I'm sure it will call into question as well this collective that runs the maple syrup business, the FPAQ, the Federation, as you've said. A lot of people will have perhaps heard of them through that Netflix documentary, Dirty Money. I think the show is called The Great Maple Syrup Heist, where the cartel of the maple syrup business were able to skim off thousands of barrels from this great reserve. You mentioned that it's been sort of lighthearted in tone in the press, and it certainly is when this story is reported abroad, like here in the UK. But what about the seriousness of this and what it means for jobs and the economy in Quebec?
Well, absolutely. And as you rightly say, I think it was back in 2012 that thieves made off with, was it nearly 3,000 tons, I think, of maple syrup from the stockpile in Quebec, which was worth, some newspaper reporting, around $18 million at that time. And again, I've seen reported that figure was around 13 times the price of an equivalent amount of crude oil, apparently, at that time back in 2012 as well. So for sure, the industry is an incredibly important one. And as I said, more than 70% of the world's supply of maple syrup is produced in Quebec, and the industries and jobs, and I guess sort of the cultural significance as well, actually. Daniel, I'm sure you'll know from lots of, say, the branding and some of the older brands of maple syrup here in Canada, a lot of those things have sort of woven themselves more deeply into the culture, the sort of visual identities more broadly as well over the years. So this most certainly is not a totally frivolous situation that we're reporting here. And I think it's worth noting the Federation has also noted that they have a plan in place to try and replenish the stocks. As you say, it's about half of the reserve that's being released here. It's a huge amount of maple syrup. But they are planning to tap an additional 7 million maple trees in the coming months, in the year to come, when the season begins again in the spring in a few months' time, to try and replenish that stockpile so that neither you nor I, Daniel, we'll go maple syrupless with our pancakes and breakfasts to come. Which is good news, I'm sure you'll agree.
They are delicious on Welsh cakes as well, Tomasa. What I'm enjoying
that,
here.
So I'll take your advice on that.
You did give me a recipe once, so I'll have to try that again myself. Just lastly, and not to make this too serious, Tomas, of course, but kind of contrasting things happening here on different sides of the country. We talked yesterday with our contributor in Edmonton, Sheena Rossiter, about the floods in British Columbia. And there are stories in the news of the CBC and others about, a shortage of Christmas trees this holiday season. Now we're talking about a shortage of maple syrup. I wonder if it sort of shifts into reality climate change for people in Canada and perhaps how the conversation will carry on going forward.
Yeah, it's a really good question, Daniel. I think the climate change conversation, which I'd say the link in the news coverage here, at least with this maple syrup story, the short, warm spring, hasn't been made totally explicitly in the coverage you've seen so far. But you're right, Canada really has seen the effects of climate change this year more acutely, I think it's fair to argue, than it has for many years. We had record-breaking heat in large parts of Western Canada over the summer. Now, as you rightly say, these really devastating images in British Columbia, with more storms forecast, I believe, today. And some advisors are warning that those storms are the worst so far. So I think, you know, there really has been a very sharp debate, a very sort of new reality, if that isn't putting it too strongly, on how people sort of, particularly if you're living in British Columbia and Western Canada, how people view what climate change means. And if you look at British Columbia, there have been very serious supply chain issues caused by these landslides, these floodings that have taken over, you know, large swathes of the territory there. Some of those supply chains have now been put back in place. But again, it's a very precarious situation as we are forecasting more bad weather on the way, it seems. So yes, it's definitely sharpened the debate, Daniel, as you rightly say, this past year, given how many extremes of weather certain parts of Western Canada have experienced firsthand this year.
Tomas, thank you for this. Tomas, actually, on the way to the grocery store, he tells me before we joined to get his share of maple syrup, I'm sure. Get back to your breakfast, Tomas, and we'll speak to you again soon. That is it for today's edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Emma Searle, our researcher, Lillian Forsett. Our studio manager today was Christy Evans. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time, 1300 in Zurich, midday here in London. And I'll be back a little bit later with some more music for you and great programming. We've got The Urbanist and The Stack coming up as well. Tomorrow, we look forward to a brand new episode of The Entrepreneurs with yours truly. Do stay tuned to Monocle 24. I'm Daniel Bates. Goodbye, and thank you so much for listening.